So you're really in for it today. I hope you have your thinking caps on, because today is going to be a day of some fairly profound thought. Starting that off, about half an hour ago, I started thinking about something, which was a big revelation to me. Some of you might go, oh my God, it took them that long to realize this. But I'm going to tell you what I just realized, okay? Because it's a good preamble to the sitting that we're going to do, the meditation that we'll do. I was thinking about wisdom and passion and how they seem to be opposite. That is, wisdom is taking a step back so you can see things clearly. Passion is taking a step forward so that you completely unify with something. So they seem to be opposite abilities that the mind has that most people don't develop very much. They don't have this ability to be wise, to take the step back and see things clearly without being involved. They don't have the ability to really step forward and totally give themselves to something. They're kind of stuck in the muddy middle. So these two skills I've always felt to be the complementary skills of a mature mind. The ability to be wise and the ability to be passionate. And these two seemingly opposite things also seem to be the difference between East and West. The East says, disidentify, be dispassionate. The West says, flow, get into it totally, be totally engaged. And these things seem to be opposite, yet they both are the two things that are identified as leading to the highest happiness. In the East, the happiness is a transcendent happiness. In the West, the happiness is a happiness of loss of self into something that you're doing, in flow, you know, the greatest engagement state. And when I thought that, first of all, not two. That's what they say in Zen, right? Whenever you see two, there's something more to be learned. There's a unification. So I thought, not two, but I'm always stuck in this two, these two different things. And then I thought, that's it, the loss of self. That's the unification. That is when you, as I'm going to describe when I talk about how to sit, when you take a step back, you witness that which is happening, and then you begin to witness that without being attached to it. It's not you anymore. It's just phenomena, right? So you lose the attachment to those things, and then after a while you lose the attachment even to the one watching. The self, you know that. Buddhism is about eventually the self kind of dissolving. So there's no self there. There's no me there. And when you do that, then there's no difference between the watcher and what's watched. There's non-dual consciousness, as Rod would say. There's unified consciousness. That is... all that remains in that enlightened state is a oneness. In whatever you do, you are that thing. There's no difference between thou and that, between thou and that, right? It's just whatever you do, that's what is. When you chop wood, chopping wood is the only thing. There's no you chopping wood. There's only the chopping woodness. So that's that unified state, that state of being entirely one with existence. That's, yeah, Chris?
I'm just thinking, though, wisdom could be all-encompassing, whereas passion can just be...
No, I'm getting there. I'm getting to that other... I healed all the dualities while I'm shaking, okay? I really did. I got them all into one, okay? So... when you're in that enlightened state of having stepped back even from self, then there's only this feeling of oneness, which is another way to say love. That is, there's just a love from which the Bodhisattva expresses in every action. There's just the embodiment of a unity, a love. a non-separation. Right? That's in the enlightened state. Now, what about in the state of being impassioned about something, of flow into something? Well, think about it. That's easy. When you're totally involved with something, there is no you. Because there's no you to stand apart. There is just what you're doing. And that just what you're doing is a pure state of love, not just for that thing, but for every, there's only the love. When I'm doing the photography, I don't know I'm doing photography. There's no photography, there's no me. There's just something that is a unified state expressing. At that moment, by doing my photography, I am an embodiment of love. Same exact thing. Does that make sense? I mean, so the two ends go to the same point, which is the source point, the source of the point of love. Allison.
Now, the only problem is, in this day and age, you might be chopping the wood and have your ear plug in whilst talking on the phone.
So that's the usual middle state, which is neither a state that is able to open inward or open outward. We're caught in this middle. And that's the problem, is people aren't happy because you need the connection. And ultimately, you need the cosmic connection. You need the feeling of that there's a love that supports the moon and stars. You need when you're caught in yourself and in the distinctions between what you're doing and other people and stuff, that's a state that creates anxiety and depression. But when you have a feeling of love underneath you or above you, that creates a release from those difficulties.
I accept that, but don't you also accept that we're entering more and more fractured states whereby we're not allowing that single-minded devotion of chopping wood, and instead introducing this fractured state, which is a little bit problem?
Yeah! I think we're seeing that problem. I think that this is the contraction before the expansion. You know, this is a state of a great deal of challenge. Yeah, I agree. I think that it, but again, things have to. It's a spiral, and so you keep coming back to the same points at kind of a higher level. So this is a point of contraction at a higher level than the last contraction, is the way I see it. It's a birth condition. What Rick Tarnas didn't say, I'm going to give you a whole lecture on what Rick Tarnas actually said when he didn't really say it, those of you who came. I'll give you that $20, money's worth. So what Rick said is we're in a birth process, and we're birthing a human. Maybe. This is not necessarily a successful birth process, but this is a point of contraction. You know how in a birth process there are contractions. This is a point of contraction. Okay? And a pretty far along the birth process point of contraction, given what the stakes are right now. So yeah, I agree. That's why we're sitting here, is to kind of maintain a larger perspective in the midst of the minutiae which threaten to overwhelm us. But we'll get there. So what I just told you is a little theory, okay? The idea that the two things that we're talking about, wisdom and passion, being able to step back, be mindful, get a clear view of things, and being able to step forward and join completely with something, they lead to the same feeling of unity, which is a feeling of love. They lead to an experience of that is restorative, that is it restores your soul. What's that, by the way? Is that somebody singing?
It's a blower.
Oh, it's a blower. Oh, I took it as somebody singing. What did I do?
It's your state of mind.
I don't know. I thought it was somebody.
It's one note.
One note, yeah. I thought it was somebody with a really good voice. Okay, so anyway, Michael.
Eckhart Tolle talks about happiness coming from the outer purpose being aligned with the inner purpose. And the inner purpose is about awareness and the things like you talk about a lot with meditation. But don't you think it might be possible to have both of those kind of at once? where, like when you're taking pictures, you don't walk over a cliff or you don't endanger your subject. There's something that's still involved with what is grounding to you. I mean, what is near and dear to you, what principles, whatever you want to call it, but your inner self. You don't lose that when you're flowing with your photography. Hopefully.
I kind of do, actually. And sometimes I find myself in the middle of traffic or on a cliff that I don't know how I got to. Yeah, I do. And I think sometimes the problem with passion is you can lose all perspective. But I think ideally you wouldn't. You know, ideally you wouldn't. So one more unification. What was that one that was just going through my mind? One more unification is the unification of mind and heart, which in Buddhism, you know, they talk about the heart-mind. So one way to look at this is the wisdom is the apotheosis of mental functioning. And passion is the apotheosis of emotional functioning. Total love and complete understanding. And what I've just said is if you look at those two things, you can take those two things to their extremes, they join in the heart-mind. They're not separate, they're not different.
Spencer, I forgot the first one, and what did you say? Wisdom is the apotheosis
of mental function.
Okay.
It's the highest kind of, highest
cognition.
Form.
Cognition.
What?
Cognition.
I stay away from the word cognition. I'm not sure what it means. It seems to mean different things to different people. Of mental function. Of the way your brain works. And the other one is how your heart works.
I still maintain a person who is passionate, let's say an artist, can have the apotheosis of emotional functioning for that field only. It can be a perfect jerk in other things.
When she or he comes out of that, then he or she goes back to the personality of being a jerk. But when you're in that state, there is no you. When you're in a flow state, there is no you. There is only something becoming. There is love expressing.
But the wisdom, they are consistent overall.
No, only when you're in that state of being non-attached and not selfing do you have that kind of wisdom. The minute you come back into yourself, you say, oh, I'm really smart about that, and then you're the academic jerk that you were before. The problem is ego reasserts itself. Stephen Gaskin, the guy who did the Monday night class in Haight-Ashbury, probably nobody knows about that to me. Okay, all the hippies used to come to the Monday night class, and Stephen Gaskin, this guy with a long beard, who was living in a group living situation, would do these wisdom talks. Actually, there's a book called Monday Night Class that he wrote, which is probably very rare now, that is a beautiful book. In any event, Stephen Gaskin used to say, ego grows like barnacles on the physical plane. It just keeps coming. And that's why you find all these enlightened gurus with the Rolls Royces and the Virgins. It's because ego grows like barnacles on the physical plane. You know? And if you have any impurity in your system, something will crystallize around that in terms of ego. Which is why you don't stop practicing. But anyway, which is why you don't stop practicing, because you need to keep letting go of that which seems to keep reasserting itself, because we live in bodies.
Scrubbing out the barnacles.
Yeah, exactly. Let's do a little barnacle scrubbing. So what I want to suggest to you is, because this has been what Fritz Perls would call elephant shit, a lot of, not just bullshit, but... Yes, Catherine, thank you. What I want to suggest to you is, I want to make three announcements and then suggest something to you. Three announcements. Mind Supermind is October 23rd. You want to use that one? Okay. Mind Supermind is October 23rd, Monday night, in the Garvin Theater in SPCC. And it's $20, and it's Jack Canfield talking about putting it all together. How to do it, how to get to be the person you want from the person you are, pulling all these different techniques together. So it'll be interesting to see how he synthesizes the stuff that we know about. Okay. So that it'd probably sell out, and I don't know where it is now, but it's probably pretty close to that at this point because he's so well known. That's Monday, October 23rd. Life Stories. There's a red book there that you can take home if you like. If you want to put addition to that, you give two copies to Donna, or you give, or you email Robert at SWT.org. So you can do either or both of those, and you will become part of the chorus of voices of people that are in this class. Art fair. Last week of class, 10th week of class, whatever, mid-November, we're going to have an art fair. I hope that people will bring their art and put it all around the room, and we'll kind of look at all that stuff. You can do that at any point, but you're totally encouraged to do that on that last class. But you can bring your art anytime and put it up. So, mindfulness. Mindfulness, the capacity, this is just one definition, there's many. The capacity to watch, the capacity to watch without trying to do anything about anything. The capacity to watch without trying to do anything about anything. So there's two stages in that, developing that capacity. That person's really holding their breath for a long time. The first capacity, or the first of the two stages, is developing the watcher. That's not so easy. It's really easy to relax and kind of drift off, but to be present for what's happening, the sounds, the thoughts, the feelings, as they emerge, that's something that you're, that's a new capacity you're wiring into your brain. So that's a significant development, is to, oh, there's a thought I'm having, oh, there's a feeling, oh, there's a sensation, and just watch this stuff come up in your awareness. Step one. Step two is non-attachment to this stuff. Not my thoughts. Not, oh my God, how am I feeling that? Or I wish I weren't feeling that. Step two is not operating on the things that appear. That's pretty hard to do. Not having an opinion about that or that or that, or trying to change that or that or that. So that eventually it's just phenomena. It's not you. It's not something that impels you. So, if there are three steps, I'm going to make up three new steps to mindfulness. Step one is find your breathing, you relax. At every level, you let go, you release, you let go, you release, find your breathing. Step two is you watch. Whatever's coming up, you just go, oh, look at that, look at that, look at that, look at that. And step three is you disidentify from that stuff. So it's just perturbations of awareness. It's not me. So it doesn't impel you to do anything about. Okay. The elephants have relieved themselves. It's time to meditate. So let's sit for 10 minutes. Bottom line on all this is if you can feel your breathing, you're at least somewhat present. If you can't feel your breathing, I don't care what you're experiencing, you're lost in thought. So you keep coming back to your breathing, and you soften and open around it, and you notice whatever you notice. don't waste energy in resisting anything. Embrace everything. Let everything be just as it is. I was hoping that that opera singer would come back. And it did, because what's interesting is to see if you, when it was first happening, you know, for the first few minutes of our sitting, if you were resisting it, you were spending a whole lot of energy for no result, right? Because you're not liking that sound didn't have anything to do with whether that sound was going to come or go. So it was wasted energy. Furthermore, it distracted you from all the other things that were happening. So that's a lesson that we get when we become mindful, is how much of our life energy we spend trying to do stuff about the world, like pull it closer or push it away, that it just wasted energy. So when it came back, the question is, did you immediately go, oh, there it is again? Or did you just go, oh, okay. When Jack Kornfield was a young meditation teacher, he talked to, I'm trying to remember who it was he talked to. I don't remember, but some older meditation teacher. And he said, you know, I don't know how to help the people that are coming to me. You know, how can I make them better? How can I help them heal? And the more experienced teacher said, I don't help them heal. Well, what do you do then? I help them be okay with what is. You know, I just remember that. I help them be okay with what is. So the idea is, can you be okay with what is? Because most of what is, you're not going to do anything about, except waste your psychic energy and your physical energy, I guess, trying to either hold it or push it away. Buddhism in one word, non-attachment. It is. Don't try to grab it. Don't try to shove it. Easier said than done when the stuff comes up, and oh my God, there's my childhood problem. It's hard to be non-attached, but that's discipline. And the more non-attached you are, the more clearly you can see it and the more deeply you can see it. And ultimately, you see through all the layers of self, and then you are greatly freed from your drama. But that's not what I want to talk to you about, though. So, is there any comment or question real quick before we go into the lesson for today? Okay, let's go into the lesson for today. I'm going to give you an article that we're going to read together. And the reason I'm giving you the article is, first, because it's a great article. And second, because it's hard to follow somebody's reading when you don't have anything in front of you. But when we all have it in front of us, it should be pretty easy to understand, because you can read it as well as hear my voice say it. Unfortunately, the person that turned me on to this article isn't here. It's Ken Sherman. He usually sits in the front. He was the one who acquainted me with this. And Emmy, who's sitting in the back there, Emmy is actually reading the whole book that this is an excerpt from. So if you have any comment, Emmy, make it, okay? So this is Robert Wright, and this is an article from maybe a month ago in the Wall Street Journal, of all places. And Robert Wright, some of you may remember, I showed you my favorite TED Talk ever, by far, which is Robert Wright talking about non-zero, the wisdom of non-zero, in which he said, the world is going to be saved, not because there's going to be any great moral revolution or human beings are going to become more human or anything like that, but just because it's in our self-interest to cooperate with one another. As the world becomes more interdependent, it's really hard to bomb them, because it hurts my pocketbook. And the fallout falls over here. So his view of why the world is progressing morally is the world is becoming more interconnected, and so people have to treat each other better because how you treat the other person has ramifications for yourself. So he calls it business class morality. He says it's self-interest that will save the world, not any great selflessness on the part of human beings, because he doesn't see that necessarily happening imminently.
And when was that talk?
That talk was given maybe 10 years ago, but I encourage you to go to TED and listen to the Wisdom of Non-Zero by Robert Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, this guy.
He has a new book.
What?
Book.
This is an excerpt from his newest book, okay, that we are going to look at in detail because I want to illuminate this manuscript. Not with my art, but with my words.
Yeah, I read the reviews of some people were critical that it wasn't until the last few pages that he got through what he had to say.
Well, maybe these are the last few pages, because this is what he has to say. Okay, so I need a couple of volunteers to kind of pass this stuff out. Amira and somebody else. Okay, so Morty, you pass out this side, maybe, and Amira pass out that side. Let's see. Amira's coming out this way. Okay. So, Amira, you pass that side out, okay? This side out, and then I'll move. Yes, you got to pass it out to those guys. Okay. You know, Catherine, I think I want to use the other one. It's a little dark. I'm going to use the other screen.
Oh, it's not my block. It's she lived with it.
Where do you live? Julie has an announcement to make while we're getting this stuff passed out. So, Julie.
I'm making new microphones.
I don't know that. Well, yeah, maybe
working.
I do. Wait, no, maybe I do.
I need to write to the supermarket saying that it's on his third room now. I need someone to give me a right one, look to it, another one send it. Sequoia and then Canoe.
Which is West Side.
West Side.
What?
On Monday, the 23rd. Right?
It's the 23rd, Monday night the 23rd. So if you don't get any takers today, we'll announce it again next week.
Okay.
Yeah, so grab that. All right, so talk to Julie if you can give her a ride on Monday night the 23rd.
Okay.
Just to complicate matters. Michael, would you help me? Otherwise, we're going to get a very loud noise.
There goes my $100 on where the table is.
Well, keep changing. Keep changing. Okay.
Anything else?
No, thank you. I think I got it all. Thanks. Okay. So you've had enough time to read it. The quiz will be... never mind.
Enough to read it.
All right, here we go. So I want
to get one for myself.
Okay. I want to comment on this as we go along. Okay. So here goes. Okay, the meditation cure, a basic practice of Buddhism, turns out to be one of the best ways to deal with the anxieties and appetites bequeathed to us by our evolutionary history. Much of Buddhism can be boiled down to a bad news, good news story. The bad news is that life is full of suffering, and we humans are full of illusions. The good news is that these two problems are actually one problem. If we could get rid of our illusions, if we could see the world clearly, our suffering would end. And there's more good news. Buddhism offers tools for doing that job. A good example is the type of meditation known as mindfulness meditation, now practiced by millions of people in the U.S. and other places far from Buddhism's Asian homeland. Mindfulness meditation, Buddhists say, can change our perspective on feelings such as anxiety and rage, and thereby sap their power to warp our vision and make us suffer. These claims, the bad news and the good, are more than two millennia old, but they're now getting important support from evolutionary psychology, a modern study of how natural selection engineered the human mind. Evolutionary psychology gives Buddhism's diagnosis of the human predicament a backstory. It explains why humans are prone to illusions and to suffering, and why the two problems are related. And this explanation can strengthen the Buddhist prescription, adding to the power of mindfulness meditation in particular. So what evolutionary psychology says is everything that you are because it aided your survival at some point in your evolutionary path. So the question is, why we have the mind that we have? Why we have these propensities for illusion in our minds? They must have had some use. So if you want to look at the most basic level of what mind is, okay, I think about this a lot. Mind's a planning function. Okay, mind enables us to go where the food is and avoid where the predators were. Right? So you can look at mind just that way. And mind has two basic motivations. It enables us to do two things well. One is approach, that which is life-giving, and the second is avoid, that which is life-taking. Okay, so the mind enables us to anticipate whether to approach or avoid in any situation. These two parts of the mind are roughly correspond to the pleasure pathway in the middle of the limbic system, which says, hey, that's good, I want more of that, go there, and the fight or flight mechanism, which is distributed throughout mostly starts in the limbic system, also the middle of the mind, and that says, get away from that. So the two basic drives we have are get the good stuff and avoid the bad stuff. Okay? So far, so good. So far, that got us alive. We got our ancestors alive and got us alive. But there's a problem. Mindfulness meditation is an exercise in attention. It involves calming the mind, typically by focusing on the breath, and then using the resulting equanimity to observe things with unusual care and clarity. The things observed can include sounds, physical sensations, or anything else in the field of awareness. But perhaps the most important is the careful observation of feelings, because feelings play such a powerful role in guiding our perceptions, thoughts, and behavior. So notice, he's saying that the most important thing to become aware of is not your thoughts. That's the first thing you become aware of because that's the loudest. But he's saying that after the thoughts become less preoccupying and actually quiet down, what comes up is feelings. And the feelings are really key. That's very different than the usual thoughts we have today about cognitive psychology, that it's all the thought process. What he's saying here is there's a more fundamental thing, a more important thing to be aware of than the thoughts. And that echoes what Freud said and what the psychodynamic theorists say, which is that the thoughts are the tip of the iceberg. But there's something underneath that. And that's why, unfortunately, cognitive therapy by itself is often not more than palliative, that it doesn't really get to the root of the problem and it doesn't give you more than some relief. So it's really good to reframe your thoughts. I do it all the time. A, B, C, D, E, okay, what? I think I told you about that, right? What am I thinking? What's the truth value of that? How does it make me feel? How could I change those thoughts to be more truthful? Well, I feel a lot better. That works to some extent. But if you don't get at the underlying dynamic, the underlying feelings, then you can do that ad infinitum and you're still gonna be miserable. So, and here is where, so now we're at the bottom of page, second page. And here is where an evolutionary perspective can be helpful. Mindfulness calls for a kind of skepticism toward feelings. Rather than automatically following their guidance, you critically inspect them and decide which ones to trust. Evolutionary psychology helps explain why this skepticism is warranted, why so many human feelings are unreliable guides. We generally don't think of Darwin and the Buddha as being on the same wavelength, but in this and other ways, their worldviews turn out to harmonize nicely. So, first of all, what I told you about feelings. Remember we talked about what emotions are, what emotions are and what feelings are? Emotions are your whole organism adjusting itself to the situation it's in and what it expects to happen next. And that's always happening without your awareness, but it's always happening. You're always making subtle adjustments in what you expect to pop up next. That's what emotions are. And they're constant, they happen, you can't stop them from happening, they're happening in your whole organism. They adjust the way your body functions and the way your thoughts work. And when you pay attention to those adjustments, then you have conscious feelings. Oh, I'm feeling happy, or I'm feeling anxious. Those are, the feeling is the conscious representation of this adjustment process. We're generally, if you grew up in the, which we did, in the New Agey kind of ethos, we were taught that follow your heart, trust your feelings, right? Your feelings are where the real truth is. And he's saying, well, wait a minute, not necessarily. Your feelings sometimes lead you astray. So it's important to not immediately identify with the feelings, but to look at them. And he's going to now take us into why feelings sometimes are useful and sometimes are not useful. So this is written very simply, but it's not simply thought. He's a very good writer, and he knows how to write. But okay, so here we go. The Darwinian account of the human situation, like the Buddhist account, begins with the bad news. The process that created us, natural selection, is indifferent to whether we are happy or sad, enlightened or deluded. Ultimately, natural selection only cares about one thing, or I should say cares in quotes, since natural selection is just a blind process, not a conscious designer. You may argue with that, but that's the scientific position. And that one thing is getting genes into the next generation. Genetically based mental traits, including particular feelings that in the past contributed to genetic proliferation, have flourished. While traits that didn't have, that didn't have fallen by the wayside. Whether those feelings and the thoughts and perceptions those feelings shape give us a true view of reality is, strictly speaking, beside the point. So is whether they make us happy or miserable. So we evolved to have certain feelings because they help survival and procreation. This selfish gene thing, one way to look at this is the universe did something really weird about 4 billion years ago. It might have only done it one time on this planet or several times on this planet. It might have done it throughout the universe. We don't know. But what happened was this non-living, non-conscious stuff somehow became living. And that was a discontinuity, a fundamental shift. When I chip a rock, the rock does not try to get back to being a whole rock. But when I chip a tree will heal itself. Because there, life has to maintain a certain level of integrity and organization unless it will fall back into non-life. So the default is non-life. And life has to constantly recreate itself to stay this different thing than non-life. So life's fundamental enterprise is to remain alive. That's what, when we talk about the selfish gene, that's what life is trying to do. It's trying to keep itself being alive by making all these different kinds of itself such that when some of them die, they won't all die, because life wants to maintain its differentness than the non-physical, than the non-living universe. Does that make sense to people? So life is, to me, the fundamental question of, oh, by the way, I'll unify something else, which is that's a duality, right? Between non-life and life. And for a long time, it's been my fundamental duality. Life is basically different than non-life, and there's an opposition between non-life, which just wants to entropy out, and life, which wants to organize up. But then I thought, shaving a few weeks ago, no, I thought it a while back, that the physical universe gave birth to life. So the physical universe must have had some kind of, life came from non-life. So non-life must have had some kind of intention, some kind of life that caused it to create life. Because life got created by non-life, right?
Why is there some intention?
Somehow that non-life created life. Okay? Now, I don't know what you want to call it an intention, but what gave birth to life was non-life. So there has to be some sort of unity there or connection there. You know, I mean, whether it was just, whether we call it in quantum physics, we call it accident, that doesn't mean that there isn't some kind of joining. Anyway, that's the great philosophical, of all philosophic questions, that's the great. Okay, so let's see, Chris first and then Alice, and then we go back to it.
Do you remember Elizabeth Sartorius?
Yes,
of course. When she came to class,
yep.
And her conclusion after sitting on the island in Greece and observing nature, autopoiesis.
Right,
it's a built-in mechanism of survival, and she believes optimistically that even though we are destroying the Earth, that the Earth itself has such an impulse to live that it will come up with solutions unthought of, you know. But anyway,
yeah. She talks about the fact that the Earth, the physical Earth, is a living thing, Gaia.
Yeah.
And then it creates this organization by its very nature.
Yeah. Autopoiesis.
All us skeptics can say is the nature of nature is somehow to have created life at least once. Allison.
I would say essentially the same thing, where you could say the universe was a living entity in itself.
Well, whether it's a living entity, that's a stretch. Whether it's a living entity or not, the nature of nature is somehow it created life. Or life arose from it somehow. Created might be too strong a word. Okay, so anyway, so the question, let's look at our feelings, which served so well. Do they still serve us so well? and we just trust them all. Because you realize that the predominant feelings around these days are anxiety and depression. So what's going on here? Take anxiety, for example. Evolutionary psychologists consider anxiety to be natural, grounded in our genes. After all, worrying about things can lead you to do something about those things. If you worry that your toddler, who seemed to have wandered off somewhere, may get devoured by a beast, you'll go make sure your toddler is safe, which incidentally means making sure that copies of your genes are safe. Of course, anxiety is unpleasant, but natural selection doesn't care about that. It doesn't even care that some of this unpleasantness will be for naught, that your toddler turns out to be in the hut next door, and the nightmare scenario that for a moment seemed so real was all in your head. Better safe than sorry, from natural selection's point of view. False positives are a feature, not a bug, even though they make you suffer by fostering an illusion. Understand? It's to the advantage of your genes getting passed along for you to worry about all the ways that they could not get passed along. You want to anticipate, because you're smart, all the things that could keep your kid from continuing to survive. And so you're a factory of what if this, what if that, what if this, what if that. And that's unpleasant, but evolutionarily adaptive. Reed.
So what are the criteria that we use to make the judgment that anxiety is unpleasant? Why do we make it? Is it pleasant or is it unpleasant? It seems to me it's useful.
A certain level of it is useful. Beyond that, I defy you to tell me that it isn't unpleasant.
But what's the criteria that we say that it's unpleasant? Break down.
I can tell you that. It's actually a physical criteria. Yeah. If you have a lot of anxiety, it screws up the workings of your body. And that's why we call it unpleasant, because it hurts. It's a physical hurt. Too much anxiety. It actually harms. Too much anxiety actually harms the body. It doesn't serve evolution. Claudette.
Yeah. And it immobilizes you. When it immobilizes you, I think.
Then it's right. Then you're not surviving, and you're not taking care of your kid either. So it's a good question, but I think the difference is between, you have to make the distinction between useful anxiety and excess anxiety or unuseful anxiety. Anxiety is just alert, right? Anxiety is just pay attention. But when it goes on too long, it wears you down. It becomes the undermining of the physical processes.
And sometimes I ask myself, how's that working for you?
Yeah. So what he's saying here so far is, now we're going to solve this, don't worry. We're not leaving you in an anxious state. Okay. Worst case scenarios, which we're so good at, one thing happens and we're dying in a gutter in a foreign land, forgotten forever, you know.
Okay,
you know, it goes like that, you know, how fast. What?
If we get the corning.
Say again?
You're at this part.
Yeah, I didn't get there yet.
No.
Okay. So what I'm saying is worst case scenarios, which we're so good at generating, they're actually natural to do that, because they're part of this anticipatory process. All right, so according to evolutionary psychology, our natural anxieties include social anxieties. The ancestral environment, the hunter-gatherer milieu in which humans evolved, featured lots of social interaction. And this interaction had consequences for a person's genes. If you had low status in the group and few friends, that cut your chances of spreading your genes. So impressing people mattered. Similarly, if your offspring didn't thrive socially, that boded ill for their reproductive prospects and hence for your genes. So it made sense in Darwinian terms for our ancestors to worry about what people thought of them and their offspring. Here, too, false positives could arise. Our ancestors presumably worried about some things in their social environment that turned out to be not worth worrying about. But we moderns have things even worse. The false positive problem can be compounded by the fact that anxiety no longer operates in the environment for which natural selection designed it. So having anxiety about how well you're doing socially in your hunter-gatherer group now is transposed into a larger group setting. Okay. Consider an artifact that has never been found by archaeologists unearthing the remnants of a Paleolithic hunter-gatherer village. PowerPoint. One thing our hunter-gatherer ancestors didn't do was give presentations to an audience consisting largely of people they didn't know. Maybe that's why the prospect of doing this fills some people with overwhelming anxiety. Anxiety is designed for a small and fairly intimate social environment, get amplified by an environment that is neither small nor intimate. This doesn't mean that anxiety about public speaking is worthless. Worrying about your PowerPoint presentation can lead to a better presentation. But let's face it, though this anxiety is sometimes productive, it often isn't. There are people who, before a presentation, are beset by images of themselves spontaneously vomiting while talking to a crowd, even though, come to think of it, they've never spontaneously vomited while talking to a crowd. In a particularly perverse twist on PowerPoint anxiety, I've been known to lie awake the night before a big presentation, worrying that if I don't get to sleep, I'll do a bad job the next day. Been there, done that. I defy anyone to argue that this is natural selection's way of increasing my chances of surviving and reproducing. So too with other modern social anxieties. A sense of dread before going to a cocktail party that, in fact, is unlikely to lead to anything worth dreading. Or worrying about how your child is doing at her first slumber party, something you're powerless to influence. Our hunter-gatherer ancestors didn't have to navigate roomfuls of people they had never met, or send their children off to sleep in homes they had never seen. And that presumably is why these occasions can bring powerful yet typically unproductive anxiety. Our anxiety mechanism gets set off in ways different than it was designed to be set off in. The internet causes kids a huge amount of anxiety because their representation on the internet, what they put out, is seen by numerous people, some of whom they don't know, all of whom are free to comment without having to do it face to face, so they can be really cruel if they want to. And so there's always a feeling of being seen and being judged, which creates a lot of anxiety. Because if you're judged badly, then your genes don't get passed along, etc. So the fact that the whole world is watching your Instagram posts is a natural anxiety producer that is out of proportion to that isn't consonant to the kind of anxiety that you're programmed for by evolution. All right. This mismatch between our evolved nature and first of all, even in hunter-gatherer days, it was evolutionarily useful to be anxious more than it was appropriate to be anxious. That is, you wanted to worry about everything so that the few things that might hurt you didn't happen. So even then, we were worrywarts. But now we're worrywarts about a lot of things that weren't even there at that point. Right? So, this mismatch between our evolved nature and the environment in which we find ourselves isn't just a modern phenomenon. For thousands of years, there have been social environments that weren't the ones people were designed for. The Buddha was born to a royal family, which means that he lived in a society with clusters of population much bigger than a hunter-gatherer village. There's evidence that people were being called upon to speak before large audiences, and that something like PowerPoint anxiety had taken shape already. In one discourse, the Buddha's list of common fears includes the fear of embarrassment in assemblies. That is, having to deal with people that you do not know. In hunter-gatherer times, you knew the 30 people around you. That was the whole deal. You kind of got less anxious because you knew that they weren't going to disapprove of you, or the ones that were going to disapprove of you were always going to disapprove of you. So you got anxious occasionally. But now, because you're constantly walking around in environments full of people you don't know, either physically or cyberly, there's a constant threat. There's a constant feeling of being badly judged. It isn't just occasional in people that you kind of have nailed down. That people were, even in the Buddha's day, experiencing an uncomfortable mismatch between the environments their feelings were engineered for and the environment in which they found themselves may help to explain Buddhism's early emphasis on meditative practice. The meditation that is described in ancient texts would have made people more aware of their feelings, in a sense more objectively aware of them, and so less reflexively governed by them. This remains a central goal of mindfulness meditation today. You look at your feelings and you see that there are a lot of anxieties that come up, that do come up, but that you don't have to get sucked into. They're just stuff that's getting triggered pretty frequently by situations that are evolutionarily unfamiliar. So you watch how much anxiety pops up in you, and you don't get anxious about the fact that there's a lot of anxiety that you're watching. You don't get anxious about being anxious. That makes sense? You don't get stirred up about being stirred up. It's just something that's happening a lot. And it can work. I have a daily meditation practice, periodically recharged by silent meditation retreats of a week or more. And I have more than once used meditation to deal with intense anxiety. In the middle of the night, before a big talk, I have even sat up in bed, meditated, and gotten to a point where I viewed a knot of anxiety with such calm objectivity that it might as well have been a piece of abstract art I was contemplating in a museum. It entirely lost its grip on me, after which it disappeared. Perhaps Buddhists more than two millennia ago had much the same experience when meditating on fear of speaking in assemblies. So I want to talk about this. It takes some practice to be able to do this. But it is possible to, when you have intense anxiety, say, hey, I better do something. Sit down, where's my practice? Sit down, feel your breathing, soften and open, and witness the anxiety. That doesn't mean it isn't going to be huge and horrifying. But you keep breathing, and you keep watching, and you keep noticing, and you keep breathing, and opening, and watching, and noticing. And what may happen is, well, what will certainly happen is you'll become less sucked into it, will become less the defining feature. But what may happen is, after a while, it starts to lose its monstrous quality and shrinks a little bit and becomes a little more understandable. You understand why it's coming up, and it kind of loses its potency. And then after a while, it's just kind of there. And then after a while, it goes away. Now, I would feel hypocritical about telling you this, except that I have, A, used it before really big presentations, and it has worked. Even if I couldn't sleep that night, I could meditate the whole night through, and I gave okay presentations. But I'll tell you the most pointed one is, and I probably have told some of you this, I have to, you know, one of these days I have to stop talking because I'm starting to repeat myself, you know how that is. But I remember that I repeated myself, so it couldn't be so bad. It's not, have I told you this before? It's, I have told you this before. So I'm still, anyway, I had to do an MRI on my back. And I'd never done an MRI before. I'm usually cool with medical procedures. I have my, I have mindfulness training. I can put myself in, or I can put myself in a trance. So I'm pretty good with stuff. So I didn't even think about it. So I went, they shove you in this machine. It was one of these old ones that's really narrow and really clanky. And they shoved me in there, and though I've never had claustrophobic experience before, and they didn't tell me that they're supposed to offer you anti-anxiety medication before they put you in. But no, they just shoved me in and said, stay in there for half an hour, don't move at all. And the thing starts clanking and everything, you know, and I started to panic. And I'm not a panicker, but I started to, it just came up in me. It was like, you know, it was like being in a coffin, you know, it's like, and I was just about to scream, get me out of here, get me out of here. And I was right ready to do that. And then I thought, wait a minute, I'm a meditation teacher. What's the matter with you? So I found my breathing. I said, this is never going to work. It's never going to work. I'll give it 2 minutes before you yell to get out of here. 2 minutes. And we come back to your breathing. And when they pulled me out of there half an hour later, I could have stayed in there. I was having a really good meditation. It worked exquisitely. In a panic situation. So I got to tell you that maybe it's going to work. You know, it worked for me. So what he's saying is at least it will decrease the compellingness of your anxiety. And at best, it will dispel your anxiety.
The fear was if you move, they get to start over.
I guess so. I was just right. Then you have to do it again.
No, I'll tell you what it is. If you've ever had it, it's the feeling that you could not get out if there was some emergency. That's the feeling.
That's it. It's the thought that comes with it.
That because you can stand arbitrarily tight spaces if you know that you got yourself in. What's scary is that you're slid in with no way to get out.
So I mean that's a thought that comes up in your mind.
Yeah.
The feeling is not a thought. It's just a So again, with regard to mindfulness, what he's saying is it will at least lessen how compelled you are by the anxieties that come up, and at best it will dispel those anxieties, and it doesn't hurt your liver like lorazepam. It's an alternative to what we do with everybody's anxieties these days, which is just medicate everybody. All right, there's no doubt, however, that the modern environment surpasses Buddha's environment in its power to warp our feelings about, hence our perception of the world. The modern environment is more warping than Buddha's day, is what he's saying. Consider powdered sugar donuts. I have a warm feeling toward them, so warm that if I were guided only by my feelings, I would eat them for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and between meal snacks. Yet I'm told that eating that many donuts would be bad for me, that my feeling of attraction to powdered sugar donuts is not to be trusted. This is hard news to take. So before we were talking about stuff we want to avoid, now we're talking about stuff to which we are attracted. How could natural selection let something like this happen? Give me feelings that don't even do a good job of taking care of the body containing my genes. Well, natural selection designed our feelings for an environment with no junk food. An environment in which the sweetest thing available was fruit. And by the way, not as sweet as the fruit we have hybridized. I've heard about a third as sweet as the fruit we have hybridized. So a sweet tooth and the feelings it inspires served us well. But in the modern world, which features the achievement of culinary science known as empty calories, these feelings become misleading. Or should I say, more misleading? Fundamental to Buddhism is the idea that craving in general, tanha, as it's called in the ancient texts, is inherently misleading. Regardless of what we thirst for, junk food, healthful food, sex, this thirst, this tanha, fosters an illusion of enduring gratification. When I see anything tasty, I imagine how good it will taste, not how that satisfaction will inevitably fade, leading to the desire for more. And we've talked about this, right? We've talked about the reward system in the middle of the brain, the one that's run by dopamine, the neurotransmitter, and how when something is pleasant, dopamine activates the system, and you think, this is really good. And then the dopamine level abruptly falls, and you say, I want more, because it's aversive to lose the good feeling. The dopamine level lowering is not pleasant. It creates a craving. I want it again. And then the dopamine gets squirted in the system, and you go, ah, yeah, good. And then it really rapidly goes. So in your brain is built an addictive mechanism. That's good in nature, because in nature, everything that is pleasant is life-affirming, and you want to do as much of it as possible, because there's going to be times when there's a famine, and you can't eat the whole tree. Okay? So nature gives us this, get another one, get another one, get another one, because that's all life-affirming stuff. It's the approach mechanism. We want to approach the life-giving stuff. But we have drugs. We have shopping. We have gambling. We have porn. We have foods that chocolate eclairs that don't grow on trees. You know, we have all this stuff that is powerfully pleasant, and that impels us to do it again and again and again. And so this stuff that we've invented is life-denying. So addiction is the compulsion to do things which we know aren't good for us that we can't stop doing. Now, one more thing about this addictive thing, which is what keeps us from overdoing healthy and unhealthy stuff, is the prefrontal cortex, the latest part of the brain to develop. That's the part that says, ah, two pieces of chocolate cake, that does it for today, dude. Put the chocolate cake back in the refrigerator, you can have some tomorrow. That's the prefrontal cortex, which is connected to the deeper limbic system, more evolutionarily basic limbic system. And that keeps you from overdoing stuff that you know isn't good for you. But what happens when you say, just one more piece? Then you strengthen the limbic system relative to the prefrontal cortex. You change the balance. And after a while, the limbic system wins. The prefrontal cortex says, no, no, no. And the limbic system says, shut up, I'm in control here. And people with very good willpower, when they go a little too far, don't have that willpower, at least in a particular area. People that are very strong in other ways lose that willpower in that particular area. Some things are so powerfully reinforcing that the prefrontal cortex loses immediately. Don't shoot heroin, okay? People get addicted sometimes in one shot. It becomes so powerful that the prefrontal cortex says, no, 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 and they say, never mind, where's the next shot? And so some of these things are so, give you so much activation of that reward pathway that the prefrontal cortex has no control to begin with. Richard.
No, I'm just curious. It seems to be the same evolutionary developmental wisdom that makes us reach out for stuff that's pleasurable, that, you know, sustains life, didn't develop to the point where it gave us the wisdom to know when to stop.
Okay, so but it did. As we evolved a cerebral cortex and a prefrontal cortex, which balances us out, because as we get into situations where there's stuff that isn't so good, it's really good to be able to have good judgment. So we have nature did give us a counterbalancer.
But we don't listen to that better judgment. I mean,
out
of balance or something.
We do, but there comes constantly more temptation. And so we have to pay special attention to that counterbalancing. The other part of it is, unfortunately, the prefrontal cortex isn't entirely wired to the rest of the brain until you're about in your mid-20s, which is why we want to protect kids from stuff like drugs and alcohol, which they can't moderate, because the prefrontal cortex isn't wired in enough. Turns out that boys get wired, get their prefrontal cortex wired later than girls do. Girls are usually a little bit more mature and able to make good judgment than boys, which is Well, anyway, that has a lot of implications. Okay, Catherine.
So isn't it true that if people like overindulge and say, oh, I'm going to eat that piece of cake, and then they eat it, then they have anxiety because they knew they shouldn't do that. And then all this fear, oh my God, I'm going to gain weight and all that stuff comes up, you know. So we have control over that. We eliminate that kind of anxiety, the fear of okay. Problems are over, you know. Over
yeah, so that anxiety is evolutionarily adaptive.
Right.
That says there's danger there, don't go there again. So that's actually helpful to us to have certain anxieties that certain anxieties prevent us from walking out into traffic. Certain anxieties prevent us from doing stuff that would hurt us. So that's what's in the brain to help us make good decisions sometimes. Okay, so let's keep going, okay? Because I want to get further. Okay. So this is one of Buddha's main messages. The pleasures we seek evaporate quickly and leave us thirsting for more. We spend our time looking for the next gratifying thing, the next donut, the next sexual encounter, the next status-enhancing promotion, the next online purchase. But the thrill always fades, and it always leaves us wanting more. The old Rolling Stones lyric, I can't get no satisfaction, is, according to Buddhism, the human condition. Though the Buddha is famous for asserting that life is full of suffering, some scholars say that it's an incomplete rendering of his message, and that the word translated as suffering, dukkha, could be translated as unsatisfactoriness. That is, the world never completely satisfies you. There's always a fading of the satisfaction, and so a wanting of more. From natural selection's point of view, dooming an animal to relentlessly recurring unsatisfactoriness is a wonderful idea. After all, if pleasure didn't subside, we wouldn't seek it again. Our first meal would be our last because hunger would never return. So too with sex. A single act of intercourse and then a lifetime of lying there basking in the afterglow. That's no way to get a lot of genes into the next generation. Contentment is nice while it lasts, but it evaporates by design. Life wants to continue to make more life, so it is motivated to do so. Much in the modern world, from junk food to pornography to nicotine to the Facebook algorithm that governs your news feed, has been engineered to intensify tanha, our unquenchable desire for more. I'm going to lower my voice. What to do? One approach is to meditate. Observe particular cravings mindfully, thus weakening them. This is challenging, more challenging than meditating on anxiety, I'd say, but there's evidence that it can work. So not only do you witness your anxieties, you also witness your cravings. A study involving 88 smokers, published in the journal Drug and Alcohol Dependence in 2011, found that this kind of mindfulness training more effectively treated nicotine addiction than the American Lung Association's Freedom from Smoking program, which offers group counseling and a menu of therapies such as nicotine patches. Okay, there's much research here on mindfulness for addictions, and it turns out that mindfulness helps people with addictions as severe as heroin addiction, crack addiction, meth addiction. It's become, G. Allen Marlatt, the world's great addiction specialist, he just died recently, he changed from using cognitive behavioral therapy to using mindfulness for even the most severe sorts of addictions.
Who was that?
G. Allen Marlatt, M-A-R-L-A-T-T. This is the basis of dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, Marshall Linehan's therapy, which is often used for addictions. So, regular mindfulness meditation can also undermine craving in a more general way. It can lessen the urgency of finding the next big thing by deepening your appreciation of the things that you already have.
Gratitude.
When you become mindful, you are more fulfilled by what's already there, so you're less compelled to make it better. Buddhism's list of unfortunate human illusions is long. It includes misconceptions about the self that we think of as being at our core, and misconceptions about the nature of the things we see in the world, including other humans. And many of these illusions can plausibly be explained as having been implanted in us by natural selection to serve its agenda. An agenda that doesn't put a priority on seeing the world as it actually is, or on finding lasting happiness in the world that we do see. It's a tribute to Buddhism that it sized up the human predicament more than two millennia before science got around to discovering the origins of that predicament. But it would be unlike the Buddha to boast about this. If he were around today, he might instead thank Darwin for the corroboration, for explaining how humans wound up being so prone to illusion and to attendant suffering. And if Darwin were around today and joined the mindfulness meditation movement, he might thank the Buddha for coming up with a way to address the problem. This tells you what the book is from. Emmy, do you want to say anything? Is it a good book? Okay, so it's a quality book, I'm sure. So it's, say again?
It's pretty thorough, just as he's doing here, okay. Some scientific. And so it's best to do it slowly, I think.
Yeah, take a little at a time.
It's very long.
Okay, so you might want to look at that book. I'm sure, you know, Robert Wright is brilliant, and he's and profound, and I'm sure that book is also. So, Julie, you want to add?
That's a good this thing. It's really cool. I like this article.
Thank you. I do too. Yeah. And I especially like the fact that we got done on time. I cannot believe it. All right, so this is yours to keep, of course. I will see you next week. So here's a little incentive to maybe practice some mindfulness. For the things that are aversive that you wish to get away from, and the things that are attractive that you wish to overconsume.
Yeah, but then they're held up for us or not?
No, not today.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about next week.
Oh, I haven't forgotten that we're halfway through High School Opera, okay? We're talking about the building blocks. Because I had to invite those two people who are wise to talk about Buddhism. Months ago, before I had the whole thing scripted out, but people are busy, so you have to invite them months in advance. So given that the Buddhism thing interjected itself last week, I thought we'd follow it this week with Buddhism, and then come back to High School Opera, the building blocks of well-being. And then at the very last class, we'll come back to non-dual thought. We'll kind of, we'll go back into spiritual understanding. So, Morty.
What do you think this made the Wall Street Journal?
It made the Wall Street Journal because people are going so crazy that they'll look at anything that helps.